power that a lame duck president can wield.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Here we enlighten you with ayahs 261 and 262 from the Surah Baqara, recited by Ali Pahiskar.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajeem. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. مَثَلُ الَّذِينَ يُنْفِقُونَ أَمْوَالَهُمْ فِي سَبِيلِ اللَّهِ كَمَثَلِ حَبَّةٍ أَنْبَتَتْ سَبْعَ سَنَابِلَ كَمَثَلِ حَبَّةٍ أَنْبَتَتْ سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى لهم أجرهم عند ربهم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. The parable of those who spend their property in the way of Allah is as the parable of a grain growing 7 years, with 100 grains in every year. And Allah multiplies for whom He pleases, and Allah is ample giving, knowing. As for those who spend their property in the way of Allah, then do not follow what they have spent with reproach or injury. They shall have their reward from their Lord, and they shall have no fear, nor shall they grieve.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines: UN human rights experts say US president's pardon of 4 Blackwater contractors convicted of killing Iraqi civilians in 2007 is an affront to justice. More than 3,900 Americans die of COVID-19 in the past 24 hours as the total infections in the world's worst hit country inch closer to 20 million. And Venezuela's Supreme Court rules as invalid a move by the opposition-controlled parliament to extend its term an additional year. And welcome your world news coming to you live from our headquarters in Tehran. My name is Gisum Shahmadi. A group of UN rights experts have slammed the U.S. president's pardoning of American contractors implicated in Iraq killings, saying that the move undermines international law.
These pardons violate U.S. obligations under international law and more broadly undermine humanitarian law and human rights at a global level. Pardoning the Blackwater contractors is an affront to justice and to the victims of the Nisour Square massacre and their families.
The group stressed that the Geneva Conventions oblige countries to hold war criminals accountable for their crimes, even when they are acting as private security contractors. It added that by allowing private security contractors to, quote, operate with impunity in armed conflicts, states would be emboldened to circumvent their obligations under humanitarian law. Last week, Trump pardoned 4 Blackwater contractors convicted of killing at least 14 Iraqi civilians in a 2007 massacre in Baghdad. Pardons triggered a wave of condemnations, including from many inside the U.S. Investigative journalist Tony Gosling believes that Donald Trump has pardoned a bunch of thugs who took random shots at Iraqi civilians and killed them.
Well, in a way, this is worse than terrorism, isn't it? I mean, you've got basically a bunch of young men signed up to a private army. Now, what is a private army? If I wanted to start my own private army here in the UK, I'd probably come into some trouble. Except this is the vector that NATO and the Western governments are now using in order to excuse their own military from service. So when the situation gets tough politically in a particular part of the world, that what they'll do is they'll send in these private, basically mercenaries, to do these jobs. Now, I mean, if Trump was in any kind of wonder boy, like a lot of people seem to paint him out to be, you know, the people who are stuck in this either Biden or Trump, you know, dichotomy, which is really an illusion, you know, because the deep state is going to stay in power before and after Trump and Biden. I would like to see him pardoning somebody like Edward Snowden. I would like to see him pardoning somebody like Chelsea Manning or Julian Assange. We're all very much wanting that here in the UK, waiting, listening, Trump. Who are you? You know, are you? He's got nothing to lose by doing these things. He would get an enormous cachet around the world, but he doesn't do that. He pardons a bunch of basically thugs, and that's all these people were. They weren't even very proficient terrorists. They were just taking random shots for their own amusement, killing people in the streets in Iraq.
A U.S. Republican senator says he will contest Congress's next week's certification of the electoral vote. Josh Hawley of Missouri stressed that he was objecting to the confirmation because of concerns about election integrity. He added that Congress should investigate allegations of voter fraud. Hawley is the first senator to publicly confirm plans to object the November 3rd election results. His move will force lawmakers in both the House and the Senate to vote on whether to accept the results or not. Nancy Pelosi, the Democratic Speaker of the House, said Hawley's move would come to nothing. Joe Biden beat incumbent Donald Trump 306 to 232 in the Electoral College. Trump has refused to concede, citing election fraud. He has called for a rally in Washington on January 6th to persuade lawmakers not to certify Biden's win. Earlier, we were joined by our correspondent in Washington, Colin Campbell. He said Senator Hawley's planned objection is unlikely to stop the ultimate confirmation of Biden's election victory.
Yeah, the moves by Senator Hawley are expected to really not have that much impact and largely be performative, actually. He will not vote to ratify the votes from the Electoral College. He may be joined by other Republican senators, but the amount of senators would not really stop the process. Most senators have said that they will vote to vote for the confirmation of the electoral votes, as is customary pretty much every 4 years. And so what Hawley is doing here is signaling to the Trump administration that he is definitely in affiliation with it and other members of his base. And I think this is just a very polarized political season that's happening right now. And when you look at what's happening as far as the president asking for people to rally behind not trying to get these votes certified and ratified through Congress, it's really, again, just a way for him to just appeal to his base. This is something that we expected because of the very Chilonian process in which the president has try to cooperate when it comes to the transition process. He's been very recalcitrant, and some people say this is leading into an area of desperation.
The United States has registered a record high of more than 3,900 daily deaths from the coronavirus pandemic. That is according to data compiled by the Johns Hopkins University. The latest figure brings the country's overall death toll from the virus to nearly 342,000. Total infections also rise by nearly 190,000 to over 19.7 million. The U.S. is the world's worst hit country by the pandemic in the terms of both infections and deaths. Health officials have warned that the country is yet to witness the worst, with the death toll rising at an alarming rate in winter months after the New Year's holidays. December has already dethroned April as the nation's deadliest month of COVID-19. A nurse in the U.S. state of California has tested positive for COVID-19 over a week after receiving the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine. The 45-year-old nurse, identified as Matthew W., works at two different hospitals in San Diego. He said he received a vaccine on December 18th and did not suffer any side effects. However, he said he became sick on Christmas Eve after a shift in the COVID-19 unit. The drug maker said in a statement that it would review all available information on the case and all reports of any confirmed diagnosis following the vaccination. Pfizer said the vaccine provides some protection against COVID-19 within about 10 days of the first dose and subsequently boosted after the second dose.
The novel coronavirus outbreak first emerged in the Chinese city of Wuhan in December 2019. The World Health Organization said a mysterious pneumonia is sickening dozens of people. Many of the victims had visited a live animal market in the city, but authorities said there was no evidence of the virus spreading from person to person. In January 2020, China reported its first death from the disease, and the United States confirmed its first case of infection. Soon, several other countries started reporting positive cases of the virus. China imposed aggressive containment measures in Wuhan, the epicenter of the outbreak. At the end of January, the WHO declared the virus a global health emergency and rated its global risk of spread and impact as very high, the most serious designation the organization gives. But neither China's measures nor the WHO warning could help slow the spread of the virus across the world. In the early days of February, more than 3,600 people were quarantined on a cruise ship off the coast of Yokohama, Japan, while passengers and crew underwent health screenings. Later, the World Health Organization branded the novel coronavirus as COVID-19. March 2020 was the month when the spread of the virus got out of hands. Dozens of countries across the world reported their first cases of infection, while Italy declared a nationwide lockdown. On March the 19th, Italy's death toll surpassed 4,000, topping China's number of fatalities. A week later, Spain's death toll also eclipsed that of China's. Meanwhile, the number of confirmed cases in New York soared so rapidly that the city was declared the epicenter of the disease. The world's struggle with the pandemic forced Japan to postpone the 2020 Summer Olympics and India to announce a total ban on the country's 1.3 billion citizens leaving their homes for 21 days in order to stop the spread of COVID-19. Sadly, the measures were not successful. With the arrival of April, more than 1 million people around the world were reported to be diagnosed with the disease. In the following months, thousands more contracted the virus, including numerous world leaders. Borders were closed and flights were cancelled. Mask wearing and social distancing became mandatory in many countries, and billions of lives came to a standstill. Tens of millions of people across the world have been sickened by the pandemic so far. Even though several pharmaceutical labs have recently declared they have managed to discover a vaccine, until a large-scale vaccination campaign is launched, the number of infections and deaths will continue to rise.
Venezuela's Supreme Court has ruled that a move by the opposition-controlled National Assembly to extend its term an additional year was invalid. The ruling paves the way for allies of President Nicolas Maduro to take over the body by next month. Opposition leader Juan Guaido and his allies tried to extend the assembly's term after the ruling Socialist Party won a major score during the general vote earlier this month. The opposition had boycotted the vote. The U.S.-backed Guaido has repeatedly failed in his attempts to overthrow the government. He was the National Assembly Speaker until January, when his fellow lawmakers ousted him from his post. He was later stripped of his immunity. On the first anniversary of the U.S. assassination of top Iranian General Qasem Soleimani is just around the corner. Our correspondent in Gaza, Ashraf Shannon, has talked to a number of senior Palestinian officials about the U.S. targeted killing of anti-terror icon. Let's take a listen.
On the anniversary of the martyrdom of the great commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, we say that he loved Palestine and Palestinians loved him. He struggled for Jerusalem al-Quds, and God willing, al-Quds loves him. Soleimani was assassinated because of what he represents to the Palestinian resistance and his support to the Palestinian resistance. By his assassination, the resistance in general was targeted. We salute and pay tribute to this great martyr, and we salute and express our appreciation for the Islamic Republic of Iran, which continues to support the Palestinian people. We say to the United States administration and the Israeli regime that the assassination of the great General Soleimani will not stop the path of resistance and will not stop Iran from supporting the resistance on Palestine. On this way, we stress that the spirit of Soleimani remains among the resistance fighters because he has his footsteps among the resistance fighters. He loved and supported Palestine, and his heart and mind were with the Palestine and Jerusalem al-Quds.
Martyr Soleimani, who was a backbone for Palestinian resistance, is now an icon to all resistance fighters. The memory and the legacy of Martyr Soleimani will be eternal in the hearts and minds of Palestinians and will pave the way for the liberation of Palestine. Freedom fighters have died for the sake of Palestine, but Martyr Soleimani was the most prominent among them.
Iran's top general, Qasem Soleimani, visiting a group of children in the northern province of Mazandaran months before his assassination. These children were amongst many more who had lost their fathers in Iran's anti-terror operations. The top general had a message for the children, that he is always there despite being busy as a military commander. And he did whatever he could to fill the void those children had, being so kind that the kids expressed their feelings whenever they wished, even if it was in the middle of praying. But now, all those moments are over. They came to an end after Soleimani lost his life in a U.S. drone attack near Iraq's capital, Baghdad. The bad news came to the Iranians in the early hours of January the 3rd, 2020. Many demanded revenge for the killing of a person they called the Commander of Hearts. They all remembered that Soleimani was a man of the people, a man who considered it an honor to serve those in need. That was quite clear in the spring of 2019 when many Iranian provinces were hit by devastating floods. General Soleimani and a number of friends went to the southern province of Khuzestan, one of the hardest hit areas by the unprecedented deluge. There, he joined others delivering relief and aid to flood-hit people.
خیلی مدیون هستیم به مردم اینجا و هر چی ما خدمت کنیم به مردم اینجا باز کم.
He extended his support to anyone needed within his reach, a humble person that behaved his countrymen with respect regardless of his position as the head of the Quds Force of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, a key force responsible for Iran's anti-terror operations overseas. Millions turned out for Soleimani's funeral processions held in several Iranian cities, including his hometown, Kerman. The ceremonies were the last chance for people to pay respect to a person they were always proud of, not only for his brave actions on the front line, but more for his humane behavior.
Now, almost a year after the assassination of Iranian top commander Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, many in Pakistan pay tribute to him for his services to the Palestinians' cause. Javed Rana reports.
Protests in Pakistan against Israel over its unending atrocities in occupied Palestine has not been so unusual. People in Pakistan have traditionally supported Palestinians in their struggle against Israel since 1948, when Israel killed and expelled Palestinians in a mass number and occupied their land. Many here rally behind leaders beyond Pakistan's borders over their support for Palestinians. One such leader is Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, a top Iranian commander who resisted against Israel and backed Palestinians at a time when many Arab rulers not only abandoned Palestinians but also collaborated with Israel to suppress them. That is why many took to the streets in Pakistan after a U.S. drone assassinated General Soleimani in Iraq 1 year ago. Being victims of so-called war on terror, Pakistanis view the U.S. and its allies in a negative shade. Anti-U.S. and anti-Israel sentiments have been high in Pakistan for decades. So are some of the Arab rulers who have been under fire for normalizing their ties with Israel at the expense of the sufferings of the Palestinian people. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
And now with that, we come to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Supplication on Thursdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by His power and brought the sight-giving day through His mercy. He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor. O Allah, just as Thou hast spared me for this day, so also spare me for its likes. Bless the Prophet Muhammad and his household, and torment me not in it and in other nights and days by allowing me to commit unlawful acts and to clothe myself in sins. Provide me with its good, the good of all within it, and the good of everything after it, and turn away from me its evil, the evil of all within it, and the evil of everything after it. O Allah, by the protective compact of Islam, I seek mediation with Thee, and by the inviolability of the Quran, I rely upon Thee. By Muhammad, the Chosen, Allah bless him and his household, I seek intercession with Thee. So recognize my protective compact, by which I hope my need will be granted. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, decree for me on Thursday 5 things, which none embraces but Thy generosity, and none supports but Thy favors. Health through which I may have the strength to obey Thee. Worship by which I may deserve Thy plentiful reward. Plenty in my state through lawful provision. And that Thou makest me secure in the places of fear through Thy security. And placest me in Thy fortress against the striking of worries and sorrows. Bless Muhammad and his household. And make my seeking his mediation as an intercessor give prophets on the day of resurrection. Surely, thou art the most merciful of the merciful.
Great hero, general of hearts. The former commander of the IRGC Quds Force, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, the deputy commander of the Iraqi Popular Mobilization Organization, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, and their 8 companions all attained martyrdom on 3rd of January 2020 in an act of terrorism directly ordered by the criminal US President Donald Trump. But what was the purpose of this nefarious act of terrorism on 3rd of January 2020 at Baghdad Airport? For sure, the terrorist act of assassinating the unmatched anti-terrorist hero was in continuation of U.S. hostility against the Islamic Revolution and the Islamic Republic of Iran. This hostility has continued incessantly for the past 42 years. The Iranian nation's firm resistance in the face of all plots by the global arrogance has been a role model to regional nations and beyond. This public uprising among different nations has horrified the US and the Zionist regime. These nations are seriously indebted to the sincere and selfless efforts of martyrs like Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, who totally changed the balance of power in the region. The United States tried for years to destabilize Iran, but in vain. The Daesh terrorist outfit was obliterated by the courageous endeavors of Martyr Soleimani and his fellow combatants from Iran, Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan, and Pakistan. This great development totally foiled the American conspiracy of disintegrating the region and turning it into a so-called Greater Middle East. The U.S. dispatched thousands of forces to the region under the guise of fighting terrorism, but in practice it supported terrorism and didn't want to destroy the terrorists, as it was using them as a tool to further its own ends. The leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, said, "The claim of formation of alliance against Daesh is a lie. Although the Americans are opposed to the controlled Daesh, they will confront anyone who wants to really destroy this terrorist Daesh group." Americans created the Daesh terrorist group in 2012 with the aim of overthrowing Bashar al-Assad, the legitimate government in Syria, and taking control of Iraq. But they faced enormous resistance and a roadblock called Qasem Soleimani. This came whilst the Americans waged bloody wars in the region in the name of fighting terrorism. Indeed, they have pillaged the wealth of Arab countries in the region. Donald Trump chose Riyadh for its first trip abroad after entering the White House. This was done with the same motive. He called the Arab regimes as milking cows. He tried to sell weapons and rescue America's bankrupt companies through Iranophobia. Alexander Konyazov, a Russian analyst, has commented on the assassination of General Qasem Soleimani by the U.S. terrorist army. Alexander Konyazov, a top Russian analyst, said, "The fact that ISIL terrorists have been formed in the RAND think tank corporation is a clear and known issue. General Qasem Soleimani was a bulwark, a dam against materialization of Washington's plan to dehumanize the Middle East and then spread it to the other neighboring regions and the entire world. History will be the judge of everyone and everything, but General Qasem Soleimani has in fact turned into a historical figure in his own time." Dear listeners, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani mobilized and organized the resistance front against Takfiri terrorists, which were created and supported by the United States, the Zionist regime of Israel, and Saudi Arabia. The assassination of top General Qasem Soleimani was a turning point in the history of the region and the beginning of the end of U.S. hegemony in West Asia. American analyst Noam Chomsky says, "Instability is an interesting concept in the political discourse. When Iran helps the Iraqi government and Kurdistan in defense against ISIL terrorists, this measure is described as instability. But when the United States attacks Iraq and kills hundreds of thousands of innocent Iraqis, displaces millions of people, destroys the country, and initiates sectarian clashes to disintegrate Iraq and disturb the entire region and spread terrorism in the entire world, it is called a part of the American mission for stabilizing, which we should continue for the benefit of the world." The United States has breached and overtrodden international principles of law for the benefit of the Zionist regime of Israel and safeguarding its illegitimate interests in West Asia region. Iran's Defense Minister Brigadier General Amin Hatami says the assassination of top general Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani was carried out with the aim of resuscitating U.S. presence in the region and undermining Iran's regional influence and deterrence power. Brigadier General Amir Hatami said, "The people's presence in the scene and the IRGC's missile response annihilated the mock awe of the United States and the system of arrogance and proved Iran's defense power and might to the entire world." Najah Muhammad Ali, an Iraqi expert in international affairs, said, "Donald Trump's assassination of great general Mata Soleimani was a big mistake and he fell in a trap that had been prepared for getting rid of him." The leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, said, "Thwarting all U.S. illegitimate designs for West Asia was an example of Mata Soleimani's bravery and courage." The leader added, "Americans tried to cast the issue of Palestine into oblivion and put the Palestinians in the weak position so that they would not dare to struggle. But this great man filled the hands of the Palestinians and gave them the courage and ability to struggle. The failure of the heavy and aggressive operation of the Zionists against Gaza in the recent years is a reality that has caused a nightmare for the United States and the leadership of the Zionist regime."
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Thank you.
log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
European News Bulletin.
Welcome back. Your host, Saeed Puriza, here. We begin in the UK, where hospitals are treating more COVID-19 patients now than at the peak of the first wave in spring. More than 20,000 patients are currently on oxygen or ventilators, with numbers set to rise following the Christmas period when people flock to malls and shopping centers to buy presents and meeting with family members. Murtaza Jaffer takes a closer look at the British National Health Service comes under significant strain.
We're back in the eye of the storm. These were the words of Simon Stevens, the head of Britain's National Health Service, as more people are in hospital with COVID-19 now than at the peak of the first wave earlier this year. Authorities are blaming the soaring infection rates on a new, more transmissible variant of the virus, first identified in southeast England. Dr. Katie Sanderson of the Doctors Association has warned that the strain on hospitals is only going to get worse.
The volume of sick patients coming in with coronavirus is verging on unmanageable, just in terms of ambulance capacity, A&E capacity and bed capacity. We haven't seen the patients who had coronavirus infections that they've contracted over Christmas yet, because they're probably not sick enough to come to hospital yet.
Ambulances with infected patients have been forced to wait outside hospitals as capacity is overstretched. Many more infected individuals are forced to wait at home as ambulances are unable to meet the demands on the system.
This is something that we've just never experienced before. Control room staff are having to make incredibly difficult decisions to decide who gets an ambulance and in what order, quite often with huge numbers of people waiting for ambulances and they have nobody left to send.
A growing number of National Health Service staff are also off work because they are self-isolating or have become sick with the virus. Officials are now considering tightening coronavirus restrictions, with some suggesting a total nationwide lockdown to halt the spread of the new strain. Britain has recorded more than 71,000 confirmed coronavirus deaths, although some question the accuracy of the numbers when compared to mortality rates from previous years before the pandemic. According to the Office of National Statistics, the spike in fatalities for this year remains significantly higher than the government's official record of COVID fatalities.
Well, let's talk about all of that with Dr. Ranjit Brar. He's an NHS consultant, a physician and surgeon. Good to have you on the show, as always. So let's start with the latest. Today, announced by the government, 981 deaths, more than 50,000 new cases. How bad is it, really?
It's extremely worrying for us. Thank you for having me back with you. I and my colleagues, once again, are in a situation where normal activity of healthcare has stopped. My anaesthetic colleagues are being retasked from the theatres to look after ventilated patients in A&E. There's an emergency been declared in Kent, in Essex and Kent, where there are potentially hospitals are unable to take more admissions. There's no ICU bed capacity left across London, Kent, but all much of Essex. We're trying to expand our numbers, but we've got to the point where, once again, really the NHS has been overwhelmed. If you look at the fact that we're unable to meet our normal healthcare needs of the population, and are really facing difficulties even just treating the people who are turning up with this one disease.
And we're looking at some of these numbers, and some of them have beat the numbers that we saw in spring during the first full lockdown. And now there is concern of an unprecedented increase in COVID-19 patients in British hospitals.
Tell us what kind of an impact it's going to have on the already underfunded, strained NHS. Are we going to see all those Nightingale hospitals that have remained vastly unused so far being used?
I think not, and I think we found there's a distance between our Nightingale hospitals and, for example, China's response. Our Nightingale hospitals were rolled out. Unfortunately, they were planned only to look at intensive care patients for extra ventilator capacity. In fact, the London Excel Centre has been closed, quietly closed, because they were never able to staff it. So it didn't really amount to the Nightingale effort to any more hospital capacity. You're right, we've got more than 25,000 patients in the hospital with COVID. We're back going towards the 1,000 deaths a day type mark. And yesterday we had in excess of 51,000 cases, which is the largest number ever recorded, test positive cases. So this is not the end of the wave. This is the beginning of this period. And it looks set to get worse. As you quite rightly say, bed capacity in NHS has been halved over the last 20 years. So our ICU rates are some of the lowest in Europe, despite our efforts to expand ICU. So we're looking at real problems of a systematically underfunded service that is very much facing extraordinary pressures and under real strain at the moment.
And the last thing you said, you know, people, they were aware of it all happening in 2017, 2016. Doctors, junior doctors in A&E complaining about underfunding and everything else. But let's talk briefly about numbers here and the experience. The government says, you know what, when this is all over, people are going to look back and then judge who has done what in terms of governments around the world handling the pandemic. But maybe compare the British experience with the Chinese experience or with the South Korean experience.
It's an unmitigated shambles. The United States and Britain, ostensibly two of the richest countries in the world, have unquestionably had the worst response to this. We had an event, it's quite right to say, we were aware of it in 2016. We ran a staged response of our NHS to a pandemic, a flu-type pandemic, but a pandemic in 2016 called Operation Cygnus. That was overseen by the then Health Secretary. And that showed that the NHS would fall over in the wake of the pandemic. But, you know, they were unable to change the direction of policy, which was increasing privatization, outsource, and decrease of capacity, notwithstanding increase of funding. That funding goes through the NHS to private companies, and there's been a decrease of capacity, decrease of frontline available services to the British staff, the British public. And it's for that reason, for a political reason, that there was a deliberate choice not to prepare for this eventuality. And it's very rich of our government to say that they've been doing very well. Really, if you compare this to China, they're talking about the vaccine being the answer. China did not need a vaccine to eradicate the virus from their population using adequate healthcare measures where they mobilize the resources and healthcare facilities and put the lives of the people first. Our system has failed. It's failed precisely because it's the profit above the lives of people. And that's left now the healthcare staff underfunded and beleaguered front to pick up the pieces.
All right. Dr. Ranjit Brar, thank you as always. And staying in the UK, an overwhelming majority of MPs have passed the Trade and Cooperation and Security Agreement with the European Union. The bill has cleared its first hurdle by 521 votes to 73. The majority of Labour MPs are thought to have voted for it after leader Sir Keir Starmer said a thin deal was better than no deal.
Having taken back control of our money, our borders, our laws and our waters by leaving the European Union, on January the 31st, we now seize this moment to forge a fantastic new relationship with our European neighbours based on free trade and friendly cooperation.
On Friday, the UK and the EU sever ties and begin a new business and security relationship. European leaders have described the agreement as an important milestone. European Union governments also approved a trade deal regulating relations between the 27-nation bloc and the UK, paving the way for its provisional application from January 1st. A vaccine produced by the joint venture between Oxford University and pharmaceutical company AstraZeneca has become the second COVID-19 jab to be approved for UK use. It got the green light from a UK regulatory body earlier today and has shown to be 70% effective, more than 20% less effective than those produced by Pfizer-BioNTech and Moderna.
The vaccine is expected to be sought by many countries because of its low cost, availability, and ease of use. UK Health Secretary Matt Hancock has said the vaccine was scheduled to be rolled out to British citizens from January 4th. Venezuela has signed a contract with Russia to acquire 10 million doses of the Sputnik V COVID-19 vaccine, enough to begin the first phase of mass inoculations. In October, 2,000 Venezuelans took part in the vaccine's clinical trials. The country's vice president, Delcy Rodriguez, has highlighted the steps taken by the government to free up resources blocked abroad to be used to access the UN vaccination fund. The Bank of England is denying Caracas access to more than $1 billion worth of Venezuelan gold held in its vaults. The country is one of the most heavily sanctioned on the world stage, with crippling U.S. sanctions leading to chronic shortages of life-saving medication and other essential items.
This is European News Bulletin broadcast by IRIB English Radio. In this program, we covered the most recent developments all over Europe. You can listen to this program on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Saturday.
All right, let's see what's been trending on social media. The House of Representatives of the U.S. Congress has voted to increase stimulus checks for Americans to $2,000 a person instead of the original $600. But the proposal stalled in the U.S. Senate. And Robert Inlakesh joins me now to tell us who and what got in the way. Robert, good evening.
Well, it seems that at this point, the ongoing war, which it has been termed inside of the Republican Party, is being somewhat won by Mitch McConnell inside of the Senate, as there has been a rejection of Schumer's push to send Trump the bill for $2,000 stimulus payment checks for the average Americans. And of course, Donald Trump came out with this proposal that $600 was not enough for Americans to receive during this time, and that they deserve $2,000, and he pushed it. Nancy Pelosi inside of the House put it forth by unanimous consent. It was able to pass. Bernie Sanders was attempting to pressure the Senate to get a vote on this, but it looks like the entire thing has fell apart in its tracks at this point. And it doesn't look likely that it's going to happen at this point, that people are going to get these stimulus checks. And this is large part to do with the Republicans who are against Donald Trump at the moment, again, on that Mitch McConnell team, if you could call it that, inside of the Republican Party. So it's all to do with this sort of war that's going on within the Republicans. And on top of that as well, many people have been talking about the fact that it's so difficult for them to get $2,000 checks for ordinary Americans who are struggling, hundreds of thousands of people who are going to be kicked out of their homes soon because they cannot make their payments. But when it comes to providing aid to Israel, aid to Egypt, for instance, that's fine. Inside of this bill, $500 million was going to be sent over to Israel. You know, they were advancing checks sent to the military-industrial complex. There has time and time again this year been these bailouts for corporations, which number into the trillions, yet they can't even provide for their own people. The military-industrial complex, yes. Wars overseas, yes. And, of course, projects as well to investigate things like frogs, etc., that they can afford, but not for the American people.
Very good points there. Robert, tell us what people have been thinking.
The first one we've got here commenting on this says he does not care about us, referring to those who have passed it. He's looking at the bottom line while we starve. Our food pantries ran out and closed. What now? How do we feed our children? I'm so sick of my life being in the hands of Republicans. We, the people, need help now. We've got another one here as well saying, so you are telling me he can give Israel $500 million in this bill, but no more than $600 to our own people. Why is it that these scumbags will send trillions on killing, spend trillions on killing people, but won't spend anything helping us at home? Tired of this, we need a revolution.
Wow. All right, Robert in Lakesh with that story. Robert, thank you. Now, the year 2020 will certainly be remembered as a challenging one across Europe, but perhaps more so by the continent's Muslims. Islamophobia has become a major area of concern as anti-Muslim hate spreads as rapidly as the deadly coronavirus. Robert Carter has been following the rise of the right across Europe this year and sums up a dismal year of hate.
This year will forever be remembered for the spread of COVID-19. But another, arguably more dangerous disease has spread rapidly too. Hate. More specifically, hate against Muslims. Some of the most obvious examples can be seen in France, with the French President Emmanuel Macron pushing through anti-Islam legislation to prevent so-called Islamic separatism. In a later speech, the President condemned Islam as a religion in crisis, which radicalizes citizens.
Mais je demande à tout citoyen, quelle que soit sa religion.
And there is, in this radical Islam, since this is what the issue is, let's take it on board and let's name it. There is a will, a demand, an organized method to go against the laws of the Republic and create a parallel order based on the other values, developing a separatist society first off with the goal of ultimately taking total control, and that's what they are doing, gradually, by rejecting the freedom of expression and freedom of thought.
Tensions in France additionally increased when the state publicly began defending insulting caricatures of the Prophet Muhammad. The row spilled over into violence with attacks against journalists on the 25th of September, a teacher beheaded by a lone wolf Takfiri on the 16th of October, and then on the 18th, two Muslim women wearing hijab were viciously stabbed by attackers screaming, "You dirty Arabs." Outside of France, things aren't much better, with numerous incidents of far-right Quran-burning protests occurring across Scandinavia. Between November 2019 and October 2020, at least four notorious Quran desecration rallies have been allowed, despite the fact that these protests offend millions. The Norwegian Prime Minister even publicly defended Islamophobes' rights to desecrate this holy book back in August. Then there is the Islamophobic ban on the Muslim niqab, a policy enforced by many countries, despite the fact that covering your face has been proven to save lives.
Banning the niqab in France, it can be the opening door, and it's quite ironic that if you don't wear the mask in France, you can be fined, and if you wear the niqab and you're a woman, you can be fined too, which shows you the political hypocrisy that French politicians exhibit. Not oppressed, you know, I'm not suppressed by anyone, but these common stereotypes have been, you know, disseminated by the media, have contributed to the social conditioning of people in a way that whenever they see a Muslim woman who's visibly recognizable as a Muslim woman, they think, oh, she's wearing this because of her husband. And you know what? We need to save her from that, which is a total, you know, rubbish.
Austria has also jumped on the bandwagon, punishing all Muslims for the acts of a small minority of criminals, introducing new laws intended to gag Muslims' freedom of speech.
Im Kampf gegen den politischen Islam,
in the fight against political Islam, the ideological basis behind it, we are going to create a criminal offense called political Islam in order to be able to move against those who aren't terrorists but are preparing the ground for it.
Across the English Channel, a new conspiracy has been widely circulating, claiming that Muslims are somehow responsible for spreading the coronavirus. These ideas are not supported by any facts. However, the belief was so widespread it had to be debunked by a government fact-checker website. These are just a few examples, but studies suggest that Islamophobia is present at nearly all levels of society. Vaccines are being produced to stop COVID-19, but what is being done to defeat racism against Muslims?
Robert Carter with that story.
Let's take her to Bosnia now, where hundreds of refugees have spent the night in buses after an attempt to relocate them failed. These refugees have spent the past week without shelter, heat, or food in freezing temperatures after their temporary tent camp was destroyed in a fire on December 23rd. The camps have been slammed by international officials and aid groups as inadequate for housing refugees. When temperatures dropped even further on Tuesday, buses were sent to pick them up, but the authorities still haven't decided where they'll be taking them. Most of the refugees are staying in the northwest corner of Bosnia, where they hope to cross into Croatia before moving on to more prosperous EU nations. And in this segment, a pro-Trump nurse in the U.S. fired for flashing the white power OK hand signal in a viral TikTok video. Richard Sedan is with me to discuss that story. Richard, tell us what you know.
So this is a very alarming story, Saeed. You and I have become used and we've talked at great length, for example, about the problem of white supremacism in the US police force. And of course, we know it's present in all areas of life. But this first story is about a nurse, I think in the Nebraska area, who basically went viral for flashing a white power symbol on her TikTok account with about 5,000 followers, which then got shared hundreds of thousands of times.
You just saw it right there, Richard, and they're calling her a material danger to non-white patients. Unpack that for us.
Precisely. So a number of questions are raised here. First of all, how did this woman become employed by Rock Medical Group? Rock Medical Group have now terminated the woman's employment, but what safeguards, what mechanisms have they put in place to make sure the problem doesn't happen again if they're serious? And, you know, we've seen, for example, with the police and even in the UK, the UK Armed Forces, we've seen white supremacism at different levels of these institutions. But the question really is, how widespread is this problem now in the United States? Because black people are already dealing with serious conditions of racism. We're in the midst of a pandemic where medical practitioners are already entrusted with people's lives. And so the question is, how widespread is the problem? And I suppose the bigger question is, given the scope of the problem, how have black people and non-white people been affected by potential white supremacists within the medical profession? So a very alarming story, but I think really there are more questions.
Richard, the other question to ask would be like, how this will impact the level of trust among the non-white community, if you will, in the medical staff.
Well, this is a problem. There's already often deep mistrust from black communities and non-white communities towards the medical profession for deep-rooted historical but also current reasons. And we've also seen on the 20th of December, Dr. Suzanne Moore, a black physician, she died of COVID-19 on the 20th of December. And she actually articulated the fact that there are alleged many incidences of alleged mistreatment of black people and also black health practitioners. So, you know, this story here might be the tip of the iceberg. But one has to question the mind frame of a nurse who would flash
correct.
A white power sign outside right. the operating theater. Quite incredible.
Right. Before you bring us the online reaction, Richard, maybe quickly tell us about this hand signal itself. Has it been around long, or is it a recent arrival?
It's fairly recent. It's a couple of years old. In a nutshell, it started out actually as a hoax from a website online about 2 years ago. But then the hoax gained such traction that far-right white nationalists actually adopted the symbol for themselves. So it's gone from being a hoax to an actual, very visible prominent symbol of white nationalism.
All right, let's hear what people have had to say about this.
Let's go to a filmmaker, Tariq Nasheed, first of all, who says, when there are hospital nurses throwing up white power hand signs, people shouldn't be surprised that black people have trust issues with the people in the medical field. If we have time, I'll go to Lourdes, who says, the frightening thing is at one time she worked in an intensive care unit in Durham, which has a sizable black population. If she was working in an ICU or cardiac CCU, God only knows the treatment her black patients received. And we have a reaction from MB, who says there needs to be an investigation of patient records with her name on it. And I've seen several tweets along these lines.
All right, Richard Sedan with that story. Richard, thank you. And that does it for this London broadcast. Thanks, everyone.
In the limelight.
North Korea says the only way it will give up its nuclear weapons is if the U.S. abandons its hostile policy. In other words, takes reciprocal steps toward arms reduction. But so far, Washington has made no moves nor indicated any intention of moving toward that goal, says Hyun Lee Ryder in an article published under the heading U.S. Must Commit to Arms Reduction if it wants North Korea to do so. Stay tuned, please, for the details of this article. For decades, U.S. policymakers have asked, how do we get North